Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the momentous celebration of 50 years since that monolith up there went up into place. More or less, our history on this is pretty much anecdotal, and you know, memories over 50 years. We could be off by a week or two, a month or two, a year or two, but more or less, we're on target for 50 years ago when Harvey put that that monolith, that huge stone, up into place. My name is Jonathan Richards. This is Tad Richards. Harvey Fite was our stepfather, and and our mother, Barbara Fite, who had a lot to do with the design of the grounds and everything else around here, was married to Harvey while we were very young, so we grew up, at least partly, a great deal around this this quarry sculpture as it was taking place. I feel I should start by saying I'm a little unaccustomed to extemporaneous speaking, but I recently saw a movie in which I was undertaking the writing of something as vast as that. But also, you know, there's a you can see a real connecting line between Harvey Fite and Ahab and the great obsession of his life, which was the creation of this quarry. It didn't start that way exactly. Harvey always had a kind of a restless, driven desire to create something memorable, but he didn't really know what it was going to be. Grew up in Texas, barefoot boy riding a horse to school, and came east to go to college, to go to divinity school, which a part of Columbia University, which was called St. Stephen's and was a divinity school, which later became Bard College, where Harvey then returned and taught for many years. And he began Opus 40 really with not an idea of how it was going to turn out. He kind of made it up as he went. But it began, and Tad and I still remember, you know, pretty far back to some of the early stages when it was, if any of you have seen what a quarry looks like, an abandoned bluestone quarry is not something that immediately says Opus 40 to you. It's overgrown with brush and trees, and it's all piles of rubble, but the quarry workers, the quarry basically left behind when they got the better pieces of stone, they tossed the rubble over their shoulders. They probably didn't toss it over their shoulders. I'm probably giving them too much credit, but they left it there. And when the quarrying industry died out towards the end of the 19th, early 20th century, these quarries just kind of lay fallow and became overgrown. And when Harvey found this place, he had just really turned from, he had been an actor and he turned to sculpture and saw this place and he thought, wow, there are all these trees and there's all this stone and, you know, what a great place for a sculptor. So he bought it and I believe for what, about $250?
Yeah, he had 25. He didn't have the $250, so he paid $25 down and they took a note for the rest. But it was, you know, it was pretty much worthless land. It was a big pile of rocks in the middle of the woods, and he cut the area that he was going to build his house in down with a machete. He was a pioneer.
So he built his house, and then he started working on his quarry, and his first approach to it was to build a series of pedestals on which he was going to, and did, display carved sculpture, all of which he had the idea that it would work in a theme of the humanity of kind of world religion, nothing specifically religious, but it was kind of a temple to the humanity of man. There were at one point four carved pieces on the quarry, and the center one was a half-ton bluestone carving called Flame. All of these pieces are now around various parts of the ground here. But
Yeah, just we have told people for years, mistakenly, that when he carves flame in here, in the house, in his studio, and when he moved it out there, as Opus 40 grew up around it, it gradually grew out of proportion, and he realized he had to change it. We recently found out that wasn't quite the case. Discovered what I think must have been the first article ever written about Opus 40 by the novelist Henry Morton Robinson, father of Anthony Robinson, also a novelist whose new book about this area and is wonderful. And in this piece, which was written in 1945, probably, maybe 44, we found out that Harvey immediately carved it in the studio. As soon as he moved it out there, he immediately knew that it was wrong, and he had always planned to replace it. It took 20 years for him to actually do it. Part of the reason for that was he had to find the right stone. When he found the right stone, and we had the incredible good fortune earlier today to meet a gentleman who came here, whose grandfather helped Harvey move the stone, and it was in his grandfather's stream bed. It was a stream bed over by Ruby, and he went to Mr. Duffy, our new friend's grandfather, and said, sure, you know, by all means, take it. The other side of the creek, the Sawkill Creek, belonged to the Catholic Church. And as Harvey colorfully described it back in telling the story, the priest was an old... he said, you know, if you want, you're going to have to pay through the nose for it. So Harvey said, well, he was a son of an old son of a bitch. So I just outwaited him. Waited 10 years until the old priest died, and then there was no problem to taking the stone and moving it. The Duffy family helped, and we may be able to sometime soon to have photographs of that move, which we've never had before. But yeah, it took 20 years to move that stone, but as I say, we've always told people it took a while for him to realize it needed replacing, but no, that came immediately. As soon as he got out there, there was a little buyer's remorse, maker's remorse.
Now, when Ted says that once the old priest was out of the picture, there was no problem in moving the stone here, he speaks lightly. There was a great deal of problem in moving the stone here. There was no more ownership hassle, but a stone that big, a 9-ton stone, is a problem to move. We may find out more from Mr. Duffy, who, as Tad says, we just discovered today. He came to was here earlier today. But basically, what they did was Harvey didn't use any heavy machinery. The heaviest machinery he used was a truck and an old Jeep with a winch in the front. And is somebody shooting at us?
I was going to get up and move that back and forth.
Does anybody know how to turn off the gun shots here? Thank you, Tom.
I was going to add that Harvey used to say that the most sophisticated piece of modern technology that went into the building of Opus 40 was carpenter's level.
So what I remember, I was in college when this all happened, but I was here around much of that time. I remember they brought it on a truck, and it had to have been a pretty good truck. Drove it up the ramp on the left side, just beyond where the monolith now stands. They then removed the statue of flame that was there, and then removed the pedestal and dug a pit. He removed stones and created about a 4-foot pit to the level of the top of that wedding cake spiral. They then unloaded the stone onto log rollers over on the right-hand side here. How they got it from the truck onto that, I don't know. I had nothing to do with it. But they then got the log rollers and rolled the stone on the rollers until the bottom end, the narrow end, was over that pit. They then erected a huge A-frame of timbers and used, and on that A-frame they put a half-ton chain hoist up at the top of the A-frame, which they used to haul up a 10-ton chain hoist. They slid, when the stone was ready, was positioned where it was going to be. Harvey and Harvey's great friend all the time he lived here was a man named Bert Rolson, who some of you may remember. And Bert was a brilliant engineer. He was a local boy, and he had a great mind for math. If he had been born and raised under different circumstances, he might have, you know, who knows what he might have done. But he just understood things and knew how to get things done. So he worked with Harvey to cut the bottom of the monolith absolutely perpendicular to its center of gravity. And then they lifted it up by pulling it from Harvey's Jeep pickup with the winch. They had chains wrapped around it, and they would pull it up a couple of inches and block it with wooden blocks, and kept raising it like that, up a little, block it, up a little more, block it, until that process continued until they had it vertical and slid down into the hole. I think Tad has something to say.
Yeah, this was essentially the technique that was used by the Easter Islanders to raise those great heads. Instead of a winch, they had, 300 or 400 guys lifting it a couple of inches at a time and shimming under it. But that's basically, Harvey used ancient traditional techniques, which he studied on
Opus 40. In the mid-30s, he had done restoration work on stone ruins in Copan, Honduras, and that was part of his understanding of how to work with large pieces of stone. He also studied theories about the way the pyramids were built. So he drew on kind of a lot of world folk engineering to, well, I guess you really can't call the Egyptian engineering folk engineering. It was pretty sophisticated for, you know, when they did those things. But these were the techniques Harvey used, rather than getting, a crane and that sort of thing. And he wanted to do it as much by hand as possible, and he did. So when they had the stone then blocked and tipped up to a vertical position, they then hauled the chain, they wrapped chain around. You can see the indentations near the top of the monolith, and the chain, that's where the chains were wrapped around. And they lifted the stone directly up into the air, and then built the base, the pedestal, up underneath it, capped with a half-ton piece of bluestone, absolutely flat, and then they did a thin layer of leading to make it absolutely flat on the bottom, and that's all that's all there is holding it in place, other than its own weight. There's no rebar or pins. It's just sitting there, perfectly balanced, and with 9 tons of weight, it would take, as we all held our breath when Irene came through here last year to see. It apparently takes a mightier wind than that to do any damage to something like that.
As many of you know, when Irene came through, it did a fair amount of damage. We lost the roof of our house. And so when Pat and I got here, we had gotten a call from Bill, who works here and lives on the grounds, saying, oh my God, The roof's blown off the house. It's landed on the car and me and Alberta, the dog. And then before he could say, but we're all right, the phone went dead. So we came driving over in the middle of this hurricane. And we arrived, and sure enough, the roof was in the driveway. I mean, it was just devastation. And with my heart in my mouth, I came around the corner of the building, and this was perfect, untouched. And I felt, I know this is a bad analogy, but it's what I felt. I felt like Francis Scott Key must have felt when he saw the Star-Spangled Banner still gleaming. That, you know, there's this symbol of permanence that... And you can't imagine the devastation when I came in, and then this tranquility of this beautiful thing that will, you know, is for all time.
So I think that pretty much tells the story. I know there are a number of people here who, like us, who were our friends growing up and are still our friends, and this is almost as much their playground as it was our playground. I'd like to throw this open. If anybody has any specific questions or anything they'd like to say, speak now. Or as they say, forever hold your peace. Or you could do both. Cornelia.
John, I've never thought of this before, but the monolith was not worked on by Harvey. It was in that...
Right. Harvey, when he brought the monolith, when he first had his eye on that stone in the middle of the creek, of the Sawkill, all those years earlier, his idea was always to carve it. He intended to continue the carved sculpture outdoor gallery theme. And after he got it up and was in place, he still had that intention. And I remember Harvey didn't think he drew that well. So he and I would sit up in the picture window up around this side of the house and look out. And he would tell me what he wanted to do. He wanted to do an angel. And he had me sketching different, and he'd say, no, not like that, you fool, you know. But we spent some time, both he and I together, and I'm sure he on his own, sketching ideas for what you could carve that into. But as it sat there, began to kind of, you know, take its place against that, you know, wonderful backdrop of Overlook Mountain, and it just began to seem right the way it was. And after a while, Harvey came to realize that what he was creating at this point had changed from an outdoor gallery for a humanistic theme of carved sculpture, and had become a sculpture all its own. And it was at that point that he decided to remove the sculpture that had been on there. So over on the left-hand side, where that patch of shade is, was a sculpture called Tomorrow. It was an African seated figure, and you'll find it over behind you there by that pool. On the right-hand side, this circular pedestal here was where the Quarry family, which is now directly behind you on the far end of the lawn, in which actually Tad and I figured. Harvey began the Quarry family after he married our mother, and it is a grouping of a man, a woman, and two little boys. I'm the little one. So he removed, and there was another figure. Wasn't Prayer down in the...
Yes.
A figure called Prayer, which was down in the lower section over here. Anyway, at that point, he decided, no, this isn't about carved sculpture anymore. It's about kind of the unity of... I should also add the name Opus 40. For many years, we just called it The Quarry. We didn't really have a name for it. For a while, also, after an article in Life magazine came out in which it was referred to poetically as Fight's Acropolis, we referred to it as Fight's Acropolis for a while. Oh, Parade, okay. So Fight's Acropolis, we thought that sounded grand.
Harvey thought it sounded a little too grand.
Yeah, it was a little $2,000. We would have taken $2,000 for it, but the name of Opus 40 came out of a combination of two thoughts. One was the 40 years that he envisioned that it would probably take him to complete the work. And 40 years seems like an enormous amount of time when you're at the lower end of it. As you get towards the last few years, you start thinking, well, I did take that summer off, maybe I can fudge ahead. So it had the 40-year concept, and he also, Harvey envisioned the rhythms of the sculpture, the curves, the gracefulness, and the rhythmic quality that it has in terms of a musical composition. And so he took the idea of opus with a number from the field of music, and then the number came from the span of years that he thought that it would take him to get it done.
Also, because there were no plans, there were no diagrams, Opus 40 took shape. Harvey believed, and it's, I think, the thing that he most powerfully left to me as an artistic legacy, that art comes out of what you do. It comes out of the working. It doesn't come out of, you know, what you think you're going to do ahead of time. So Opus 40 is essentially improvised, and it's, jazz musicians recognize this immediately, and jazz musicians will always love to play here for exactly that reason. And we do have some people we invited. Guy Mosley, who wrote the first serious study of Opus 40, Tony and Tanya Robinson, who grew up here, are there. Tony's actually a little older than me, if you can believe that. Pixie Mecklen, Piera, a few others, and those who would like to share what we invited to share, because you bring your chairs and come up here, we can kind of sit around and pass this back and forth if it doesn't provide too much static.